Greetings, humans. You have entered the Command Zone, your destination for all aspects of Elder Dragon Highlander. Enjoy your stay.
Hey guys, welcome back to the Command Zone. I am your host, Jimmy Wong, and...
I am Josh Lee Kwai.
In the first episode, we talked about EDH deck building, and today we are back to talk about something that is also equally important to the game, but has nothing to do with deck building, really.
Yeah, I'd say equally important is a good way to put it. It's something that it's a little bit controversial, I think. I know that spiky players, and when I say spiky players, I mean players that like play to win like really hard. They generally don't like this aspect of the game. It's politics and negotiations at the table.
Yeah, and it's because it introduces the very important variance, and sometimes you can't control what happens at the table. And spiky players, I can understand, don't like it for that reason.
I also think spiky players, like in general, like they have more cards. They have more expensive cards, and they don't like that their big expensive cards don't always like lead them to victory.
Yeah,
you know, a lot of spiky players, you hear them go like, "Well, I'm the best player at the table, but I didn't win that game
because you know this happened and then this and then
yeah, they ganged up on me and then blah 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 blah." And it's like, "Hey, spikes, get over it." Like, it doesn't take the same skill set in EDH that it takes in standard or constructed to win. You know, that doesn't mean that, you know, the being the best at Magic in standard is different than being the best at Magic in EDH, because you have to balance the politics. You have to be, you know, you have to be good at like using your clever cunning to convince other players to do stuff sometimes or not to do stuff.
Yeah, and you know, you can still be a spike when you play Commander too. I mean, you could be an extremely good negotiator.
Exactly.
And very good politically. And if you can bring that as well as your, you know, standard love, then this could be a format that you could also equally do very well in.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's exactly the point, is like being spiky in EDH just is a little bit different than being spiky in standard or constructed format. But so we're going to refer... I have this book that I just love. I've read it a million times.
You may have heard of it.
You may have heard of it. It's called The Art of War by Sun Tzu. If you haven't heard of it, Sun Tzu was a military genius about 2,500 years ago. He wrote this book. And it's still read today by, like... It's like bedside reading for, like, politicians, military people, Fortune 500 CEOs. Like, it's used a lot.
It's just one of those books that applies to a lot of different areas of both business and life.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
No actual warfare is required to take the advice from
it. Well, it's funny. The philosophies of this book, you'll see, will, like, play out for EDH and Magic in general. Like, the first quote I would like to pinpoint is... Sun Tzu says... "If you will not begin with stratagem, but rely on brute strength alone, victory will no longer be assured."
Ooh, that's deep. Sun Tzu, The Art of War.
Yes. So brute strength in this case, I think, is having better cards.
Yeah.
It's knowing more about the cards. It's like having better synergy and just sort of having a better deck.
Right.
If that's all you're relying on, which I think what spikes sort of rely on, that's not enough in EDH for victory.
Yeah, not necessarily. Sometimes you can do something where it's just like, all right, you overpowered everyone. But, you know, in general, when you have multiple players and you have the spikiest, craziest cards out on the table, you're not going to make any friends.
Yeah, and if you're the most feared player at the table, like in one-on-one, that's okay. In fact, that can work in your favor.
Yeah.
But in a five-player game, like all of a sudden the other four players are going to just come after you first because you're the scariest person there. So in EDH, sometimes the best path to victory is seeming to be vulnerable. Yeah. You know, maybe playing slightly worse cards or cards that are perceived to be slightly worse, like maybe playing suboptimally. I know spikes hate all these things.
The word suboptimal is nowhere in the spike section.
Yeah, right? Exactly. But, you know, in EDH, it's political. So it's all about, you know, it's all about deception. In fact, that's another great quote I love from Art of War. He says, "All of warfare is based on deception."
Very true.
Yeah, because if players think they have no chance against you, like if you just sit down the table and like, this guy wins BTQs, he's got every card, he's got a Black Lotus in his deck, like what are they going to do? They're just going to come at you as hard as they can. You can't beat four players. Like,
yeah, exactly. Think about it. I mean, statistically, you have a card of one, you know, you have one hand, and you have four other hands going against you in a variety of different colors. So everyone's got something to at least respond to you for the most part, especially if they've crafted, you know, an EDH deck that's meant to play in the multiplayer format.
Yep. Okay, so to the spikes, I say this. Like, spikes hate it when normal players go, "Oh, I got mana screwed that game. That guy beat me just through luck." You know, there's blah, 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 blah. That's what you're doing when you complain about the politics in EDH. That's the equivalent. Don't complain. Look at what you can do different to control the situation. And a lot of times you can do things. It's just things that you think you don't want to do, like play slightly worse cards, or just don't play your biggest, scariest, you know, infinite combo piece like right onto the board on turn three. Like, if you do those things and everybody comes after you, who's to blame? You. And yeah, a lot of pros and spiky players will say, well, before I even start the game, people are going to come after me because they know I'm the best.
Not
all
true.
All it takes is a couple of games where you just sort of like dirtle around a little bit and like, you know, help other people draw cards or do, you know, things that don't seem that scary. And before you know it, they're like, oh, he's just playing EDH for fun and we don't have to go after him. And then you can be sort of subtly ruthless.
That's true. And, you know, I think everyone has elements of the spike in them. You know, who doesn't want to win? Losing clearly is not a pleasurable thing in any format or game whatsoever. So, you know, it's not even like you don't even need to be perceived as vulnerable. Sometimes you just need to be perceived as not the threat.
Correct.
And as long as you can sort of hide underneath the top threat and keep building your own stuff and, you know, getting the cards in hand that you need to win the game, then you're in a much better position.
I also think, like, let's talk percentage here. Spikes are used to winning like 60% to 70% of their Magic games,
right?
But that's on 1-on-1. Yep. If you're playing with five players, statistically, you should win 20% of the games. So if you win 40%, you're actually like well above the curve. So
yeah, you're like doing incredibly well if you win 40% of your games.
Exactly.
So I win like 10% of my games in Commander. That's what it feels like.
At least. Yeah, it feels like it. So you know, just skew those percentages a little bit. Like, just because you're a spike doesn't mean you're going to get to win 50% of your Commander games. Like, dude, you're playing against five people.
Yeah, and you know, this goes for anyone that's a spike, Johnny, Timmy, or just any subset or any combination of those two. Politics and negotiation is the most important part outside of, you know, what your actual deck does and what you're playing against. I'd say politics and negotiation, it's sort of what makes EDH into the quote-unquote board game format, where it's much more friendly for multiplayer because it requires you to interact with other people. It requires you to make deals, to talk to your teammates that you make throughout the game, to betray people. All that stuff is involved. So it's really important to be good at this and to at least practice it, because the more you play, the more you'll understand about how it works, what you can and can't do, the risks you can take, and ultimately that will help you become a better player. Just in general, too, I feel like for any kind of game.
Yeah, it's a super good point, like, to practice it, to not be afraid to sort of try certain things out, because, you know, you can get... It's a skill that you can improve on. Don't think of it as, like, I'm political or I'm not. Like, you can learn, like, oh, if I act in this way, like, people tend to get mad, but if I sort of just change it slightly, all of a sudden, like, nobody even notices me. Like, trust me, you'll learn, you know, you'll learn those little intricacies.
And just like Magic has infinite things you can do, politics has infinite things that you can do at the table too.
Infinite times infinite.
So many different things you can do,
Okay, so let's talk about table image.
Ah, yes. The best deck, usually, often, not usually, but sometimes, it doesn't win.
Yeah, I would say often it doesn't win.
Yeah. I remember, well, actually, last night we were just playing against Craig, one of our friends, and he has some... I mean, they're a great combination of like a combo deck. And
Craig has the best cards in our playgroup.
Yeah, by far. But Craig often doesn't win because as soon as we see the threat grow, we're like, all right, see you later, dude.
Craig has like alpha and beta cards and stuff. And it's like, you know, you start seeing like scary stuff that is from really early sets. And it's like everyone just jumps you, you know? So he has to be real careful about how he plays.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's a fine line to walk, but Craig still wins games.
He does win games. He wins games when we let certain... You know, he wins games based off of the mistakes made by other people. So let's say I have a removal spell and I see something on his table and I'm like, all right, guys, what should we get rid of? Everyone looks around and we sort of make a group consensus. Like, I think this is the worst because this is doing the most damage to everyone when there's another card hiding on the table that's really causing the havoc. And, you know, you make a mistake like that and that can allow Craig to win the game.
I think Craig wins sometimes, too, when he, you know, stumbles on mana and he doesn't seem that threatening, or just, you know, when every once in a while he just makes too many people mad. Like, it's just like anything else. But the point here is, like, how you construct your table image is just as important as how you build your deck.
Yeah.
So the first thing I would say is, you have to realize that everything you do is going to be analyzed by the other players at the table.
Yeah, consciously and subconsciously.
Yeah, we're going to get a little meta here. This actually starts before the game even starts. So one of the things I would say is, like, avoid bragging about, like, your past wins.
Yeah, or your sweet cards that you just got for your new
deck. Yeah, because what are you saying? You're sitting down at the table and you're saying, I am really scary because I won the last four games and I just got these three new awesome cards. And everyone's like, holy crap, let's kill that guy.
Yeah, exactly. Even if he gets completely mana screwed, he's still going to be, or she's going to be drawing all the ire immediately.
Yeah, exactly. So you want to downplay your wins. In fact, you don't even really want to talk about the last couple times you won. If you just happen to be on a streak where you like sort of won the last three games, like a lot of times, Commander's weird. People won't necessarily notice that you won three in a row. They'll know you won the last one and then you won a few, but you know.
Well, so many games come down to, you know, just 1v1 dueling it out while the other person that was the fourth player got eliminated 30 minutes ago.
Yeah,
so
and they don't even notice who like really came out on the end. They just know, well, I was the first one out. Yeah. And another thing I like to do is like, I like to point out like the scary decks. Like somebody flips over their commander and go, oh man, the Rafik deck. Oh crap. Oh, we're screwed, guys.
Oh,
we're
dear.
Dead. And
yeah,
it's like
exactly.
Immediately you're just like, no one's looking at you. Everyone's looking at that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what you want. You want everybody looking at the other guy.
You evolve that meta one level, though, and we go, wait, hold on. Your commander is equally terrifying in a different way.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's what happens now because you know, everybody's learned those tricks. But you know, if your playgroup's not that advanced yet, it's really, if you can sort of subtly do that, you just start already like putting targets on other people and not on yourself.
Yeah, and I mean, another alternate strategy is you say that, and then I chime in and go, yeah, that guy's terrifying. So
now,
I'm also casting it off of myself.
Exactly. Like, so now you sort of like you made an alliance almost. Like it's like Jimmy and I are like, okay, we'll make that guy look bad. You know.
Yeah, exactly.
Exactly. And everyone will attack him, and we'll
just
sit over here and build our board.
We're running a smear campaign on Prosh.
Exactly. That's politics. Okay, so let's talk about some popular table image strategies.
Yeah.
Okay, another Sun Tzu quote. Pretend to be weak, that your opponent may grow arrogant.
Ah, and foolish, and make mistakes. Magic is a game about not making mistakes. In fact, it's more about not making mistakes than making the right play.
Often it is, sure.
So look and act weak. And when we say weak, it doesn't mean you're shriveling in your chair and going, oh, I'm so terrified, everything. Don't touch me. Look, I'm just a poor player. We're talking about don't be popping out Elesh Norn and screwing everyone over. Don't do things that make everyone upset if you don't have the board to back it up.
Right, yeah. It's like, you know, you can even do things like sort of be like, ugh, mana screwed again. You don't actually have to be mana screwed. You can just say things like that. Or, man, I'd really love to draw a creature any day now. Like, just say things that are like, my deck's not coming together here. I'm not a threat to you people because I'm just hoping to play Magic.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And I found that EDH is definitely king of the hill. You know, if you're mana screwed or if you're not getting the cards you're getting, you know, we're all playing 100-card decks. Someone else is probably getting similarly screwed or just slightly deficient in some category or another. So if you're able to, you know, commiserate with your fellow groupies and point out one person or two people, you're always in a better position.
I mean, a lot of times, and this strategy doesn't always work, of course. Sometimes,
no, of course not, yeah.
Sometimes people are just like, okay, well, let's kill the weak guy. But a lot of times people are like, oh, well, I'm not going to worry about that guy because this other dude over here is really scary.
Right.
So I'm going to take care of him, and I have time to deal with this other person who's mana screwed or can't seem to draw a creature or just whatever reason their deck isn't like functioning that properly. And so what you can do is you can just sort of slowly, you know, subtly like advance your board, not scary, and then all of a sudden, like we said last episode, like ADH is a lot about like all of a sudden out of nowhere, you just sort of destroy everybody in one turn before anybody can really respond.
Yeah, and usually the person that's the strongest at the table isn't going to go after the weak person because, you know, when you're attacking, unless you're vigilant, you're going to leave people up for blocking, and you don't want to leave people down that can't block against someone that can hurt you the most. So the person you're often going to go after, if you are the top dog, is the other top dog.
Yeah, a lot of times that other, like if there's two people that are roughly equal, they're actually effectively protecting everybody else at the table because they have to be they have to be wary of each other.
Yeah.
So, you know, so that's one is to just look and act weak and then slowly become strong. Another quote from Sun Tzu I like is, the supreme art of war is to subdue the enemy without fighting.
Yeah.
Like acting like you have concealed strength, like projecting confidence. Things like when somebody casts a spell and you go, hold on, what does that do? And you sort of fiddle with your couple of blue mana and you consider countering it. You don't have to even have a counter in your hand. In fact, I do this all the time, which is like, what is that? And you think about it and then you go, okay, it resolves.
Yep.
You know, and what's that say to the whole table? That says, I have a counter spell. I can choose to counter anything. In EDH, a lot of times that will mean people won't cast things at you because nobody wants to cast a spell and it doesn't do anything.
Yeah, that's the worst.
Yeah, so a lot of times it's like, I'd rather cast it at some other guy just so that the effect happens.
Yeah, or it's like, I'm not going to play my giant bomb now because I'm going to wait for him to use it on someone else. And at that point, too, usually in Commander, if you're going, if I don't have to play my bomb, it's a great thing because you're not, you know, you can also appear slightly weaker
Correct.
And have that guy go after someone else. But it's all about bluffing, Bluffing is great.
Yep.
Bluffing, perceived strength. I remember one game I won with a Jaleva deck just because I had a Cryptic Command in my hand, and I threatened everyone that was trying to attack me with anything. It's like, well, you're going to attack me with their army, I'll just tap them all down with Cryptic Command. As a result, I went 4 rounds holding this card in my hand and never casting it, but I essentially had cast it every single time someone decided not to do something against
me. Yeah, that's the power of having it in your hand but not using it, is you actually effectively use it whenever it like stops thwarts aggression that's coming towards you.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a brilliant use. You know, you can do this with removal spells, with counter spells, board wipes, you know, all kinds of effects. You can just sort of, you don't use them, you just threaten to use them. You just say, I have the bomb, and I will push the button. So are you sure you want to come at me? Maybe you want to go at somebody else.
Yeah,
and a lot of times they go, I'll go at somebody else.
I'll go at someone else. Yeah, it's like, fine, I'll take, you know, and a lot of times if the deck is strong enough, the person will go, I'll take care of you later. And you just hope that you can get to the point where they can't actually take care of you. I think Nevermaul's Disc is a great example of this, because you can activate it at instant speed once you get a full round and gets untapped. And it could be in response to anything. And you get
and
to choose
when
it blows
up. Because it's an artifact.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah, and it destroys all. What Nivinrael's Disc is an artifact you put on the table, and then it comes into play tapped.
Mm-hmm.
But then once it's untapped, you can sacrifice it. And
with
you
one mana, I believe.
Yeah, with one mana, and you destroy all artifacts, enchantments, and creatures.
Just full wipe, including itself. It'll hurt you as well, but it's an incredible reset button. It's the biggest red button at the table ever, because everyone sits there and goes, well, do I want to play my creatures or wait until he pops in? Then, you know, I'll still have a hand to play.
Yeah. And but if I have creatures on the table, do I want to attack him? Because then he's just going to pop it. And it's like, well, maybe I can get some damage on somebody else. It's a big red button.
Yeah. If you think about it, though, they're only going to ideally pop it when things are completely dire for them, or it's in the best situation for them.
Yeah. I know a lot of play groups, what happens if somebody puts that out is if there's just sort of an agreement that everybody starts attacking that person until they pop it off.
Until they pop it off, yeah.
Otherwise, they just got the table by the... They got the table by the throat.
The throat, exactly.
They have the table by the throat. That's,
exactly.
That's what I meant to say all along. Okay, so another table image. Well, let me start with a Sun Tzu quote. He says, appear weak when you are strong, and strong when you are weak.
Oh, nice.
So sometimes showing a lot of board strength, like casting out your creatures and just having more creatures than most people.
Playing a deck with Kalia as the commander is appearing strong when you potentially could have the worst hand in the world.
Exactly. Nobody knows. But you can sort of promise swift retribution to anyone who comes at you. You can be like, listen, I've got this stuff on the table. Anybody who does anything to me, that stuff's coming at you.
Yeah, exactly. Especially if you have, like, for instance, your deck's with a guy that has death touch and can deal one damage to one thing.
Yeah, if you have some sort of...
You know, there's all sorts of great removal, like... Assassin. What's his
Royal
name?
Assassin.
Royal Assassin. Yeah. It's a great card that just sits there and everyone goes, well, I'm not going to tap anything past turn.
So this is a dangerous stratagem, I have to say. It can be effective, but just remember, I'd say usually the person in the lead at the beginning of an EDH game doesn't win because you know, you're on the top of the hill and everyone's trying to pull you down. And if you're the first one on top of the hill, you're going to get pulled down at some point. You want to be the last one on top of the hill.
Your likelihood of being pulled down is the greatest too, because you have three, four people against you from the very get-go.
But sometimes, you know, that's your only route to victory. So don't completely forgo this strategy sometimes. Sometimes your hand's not great and your best chance to sort of hold everybody off is to sort of bluster, to sort of look scary when you're maybe not.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one of the important things about appearing weak when you're strong and strong when you're weak is more just you don't want to confuse people, but you don't want people to know what your strength actually is ever.
Mm-hmm.
And that way, if someone does attack you and they're like, all right, I'm going to do this, you're like, all right, well, too bad for you. I do something in response to it. Everything dies, et cetera, et cetera. You don't want people to know what your strength is, because once they do, then they can gauge whether or not they want to engage you much better.
Right. All of warfare is deception.
Deception, indeed.
Okay, so another quote from Sun Tzu that covers another table enemy strategy is, the wise warrior avoids the battle.
Ooh, very zen.
Mm-hmm.
The wise warrior just meditates.
The wise warrior just meditates. So I think there's actually a deck in EDH that doesn't exist in any other format, and it's what's called the group hug deck.
Yeah. Definitely doesn't exist in any other format.
Yeah, couldn't, I guess, there's in a one-on-one format.
There's no group hugging.
This is a deck that's sort of built to sort of buy friends, if you will, or make friends. It's like, oh, I'm going to play these cards that help other people draw cards or give other people mana.
Here's Howling Mine.
Yes, or buff other people's creatures. You know, it's like, oh, I'm friendly. I'm actually just helping everybody else.
Yeah, what's that Spectral Searchlight that was in Conspiracy and was reprinted?
Yeah, exactly. You tap it and you can give one mana of any color to any player, including yourself. Yeah, exactly. But, you know, you could be like, oh, you want, oh, you're mana screwed. You need one green mana. I'll give it to you. Just don't attack me.
Yeah, exactly. You can buy friends.
Yeah. This is politics at its finest. This is really like lobbying.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
It's you're just like, oh, you're powerful. I'll make friends with everybody. And then, you know, you guys attack each other. And then when the dust clears, then I'll clean it up.
Yeah, exactly. But you have to be careful with this, too, because, you know, someone that's more in tune will realize, like, hold on, this guy's just buying friends left and right and will do their best to actively stop it, too, which is always something to be wary of.
And everybody knows that they've got to kill everybody else eventually. So they're always like, eventually I'm going to have to take care of that guy.
Yeah.
But you just, you know, you hope you just haven't quite given him enough rope to hang you, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you give him a little bit, but not a lot.
And oftentimes I'll never promise someone past one turn. You know, I can't be like, all right, I won't attack you forever. It's I'll give you a turn.
That's rare.
You know, and then we can talk about the next time it comes around. But
sometimes if somebody's almost dead, though, and you save them, you're like, listen, you're going to die.
Yeah.
I'll save you. But what that means is, like, you have to attack that person for the rest of the game. And then once they're dead, fine. But
yeah,
like,
exactly.
And I'll make that deal happily if I'm the buyer that's about to die. Because I'm either going to die or I'm going to keep playing Magic.
Yeah. And I think the prospect of being third place or second place, you know, it's like, I'd rather be second.
It's a little bit better. And there's always those people at the table where it's like, hey, at least I beat you.
Right. Yeah. I don't like that guy, but he has a point. He did beat me.
Yeah, exactly. There's a quote, actually, from another author that I really like, Niccolò Machiavelli, who wrote The Prince. And on the question of, is it better to be feared or loved? This comes up at the table a lot.
Yeah.
And he says, the answer is that one would like to be both, but because it is difficult to combine them, it's much safer to be feared than loved. And the reasoning for this is that because if you make a commitment in time of peace, it's not always kept when there's adversity.
Yeah.
But if you make a commitment out of fear, then later it will be kept out of fear.
Yep, correct.
So, you know, group hug is another strategy. I think it's a little bit difficult, you know, sometimes.
It's difficult. You need to build a deck that's group huggy that can also have win conditions is the big one. You know, you need to... Group hug is more, ultimately, I think the best group hug is deceiving people into not attacking you because you're giving them so much and then using what you're giving them to destroy them.
Yeah, and you can also have things in your deck still that, like... I'm giving you this stuff, but if you turn around and come at me, I'm going to destroy that creature, or I'm going to wipe the whole board, or I'm going to do stuff.
Exactly.
Like, you still want to have, you know, them be scared of you on some level, you know. Can't just be like, oh, that guy's happy-go-lucky, he's just drawing everybody cards, and he can never, ever harm me, so I can just attack him whenever I want.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, you always have to, you know, appear strong when you are weak, right?
Yeah. Okay, so our next section is the politics of action. Here's another good Sun Tzu quote. Move not unless you see an advantage. Use not your troops unless there's something to be gained. Fight not unless the position is critical.
I see this happen very often with new players all the time.
Yeah.
In any format of any game ever.
Yeah.
They're like, well, I have this stuff. I can attack, so I'm just going to swing.
Yep, I'm just going to turn my stuff sideways no matter what.
Yeah. It's like, oh, boy. Whoa. Slow your roll.
Especially in EDH. Like, you have to think, like, what am I getting? And what is it costing me? Because there's always a cost, and there's sometimes a gain. There's not always a gain.
Yeah.
You know, the cost can be like, oh, I've got this 2/2 cat soldier token. I have it. I'm going to attack the player to my left. What'd you just do there? You did 2 damage. That's nothing.
Yeah,
you just made somebody mad.
Yeah.
You know, when they have something to attack with, which may be like an 8/8 flyer with indestructible, you know, who are they coming at?
Probably you.
Like, unless somebody else has done some damage to
you. Yeah, exactly. Or, you know, it doesn't even have to be a flyer. It could be like a 12/12 on the ground, and all of a sudden, the thing that you could have chump blocked that was a token, nope, you're taking 12 damage.
Yep.
So,
make sure that you weigh what your advantage is, what the cost is going to be. You know, don't... It's in EDH, very often, very, very often, the best idea is just to not attack.
Yeah.
Is to not make enemies. Because if you can't back up the enemies that you're making, like if you can't actually, like, you know, do real damage to somebody and keep yourself protected, a lot of times it's not worth overextending.
Yeah. It'd be like an actual war if two sides were at a standstill and slowly building their armies up. And one side was like, all right, I'm just going to toss 100 of my troops at you. And it's like, all right, you lost 100 troops and you did minimal damage and they're the ones defending. So technically they have the advantage if they know the attack's coming. Now, there are times that you should attack if you need to. For instance, with Marchesa Dethrone, could be very handy to get +1/+1 counters on your guys. And you can even...
You have lifelink.
Yeah, exactly. Lifelink. I mean, you can even phrase it like, hey, look, I'm only attacking you. It's only for 4 damage. It's just to get +1/+1 counters on you. I'm not going to attack you again from this point out. But at the very same time, you're still doing damage to people. And
you just have to wait. But, you know, I like what you said there because there's 2 ways I can do it. I can attack you or I can attack you and I can say that.
Yeah.
Now, the outcome is the same. I still do damage to you and maybe I gain life or whatever I've got. But right. in one, it doesn't feel as bad.
Yeah.
So that's called being political. It's not that you're doing anything different than you were going to do. You just couch it. You know, you just mm-hmm. you let them know what's going on and it doesn't feel as bad to them. And maybe they don't like hate you forever and try and kill you for the rest of the game, you know, and maybe they do. Maybe they don't. It's just a way that you can do it. Another way people use I see a lot is they sort of assign everybody a number at the table and then they roll a dice.
Right.
You know, and that's another way to make it feel like, hey, listen, I have to attack because I'm getting some sort of advantage from it. But, you know, I'm not trying to pick on anybody. So yeah, I'm just letting chance decide who it is. And, mm-hmm. and you know, when you're the guy that's like your number comes up, it doesn't feel as bad. And,
yeah,
you sure. know, so I may not just go right after that person for the rest of the game again because it's like, you know, they had to attack because mm-hmm. they needed to get some advantage,
yeah.
you know, from their creature requires attacking.
Yeah.
Although you can take the opposite stand if you're the player that got hit. And I like to take this stand a lot, which is like, I don't care the reason. If you attack me, you're attacking me.
Yep.
You can say whatever you want. You did damage to me. So you're now my enemy.
Yeah.
So do you want to make me your enemy or not?
Or even so, like, I will get retribution. I will ping you back for the same amount at some point.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
Yeah. It's definitely interesting. I like the dice rolling technique. You know, we have four players mm-hmm. at the table. You're 1, 2. This person is 3 and 4. And the last person is 5 and 6. You roll a dice. All right. You're going to swing at that person. And they're going to have to take the damage. I also like it because... It really puts interesting things into play. It's like, well, technically, you're going to want to attack the person that can do the least damage to you in return.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, you're not going to win this game by just killing one person and having everyone else look at you. The best way to win, it's a war of attrition in the beginning. Mm-hmm. You know, you need to lower everyone else to the point where you have a comfortable enough lead life-wise that you can take out multiple opponents in one turn.
Right.
So doing that is actually nice. You can equalize the board in terms of where everyone's life is at, and yours is hopefully higher than everyone else's.
It's dangerous, though, because if you roll those dice like 3 or 4 times, now you've hit every single person at the table. And it's like, uh-oh. Instead of you might have been better. Like, if that can work for 1 or 2 dice rolls. I think if you're going to attack with that guy, you know, 4, 5, 6 times, now you've taken huge chunks from every person at the table.
And no one's going to be happy.
Now, all of a sudden, like, you just made 3 people come at you pretty hard.
Right.
You know, you're never going to win that. Not never, but it's going to be tough to win that game.
Yeah. What started off as a fun, like, oh, I have a 33% chance of getting picked, turns into, great, this is the 6th time he's done it.
Yeah.
I do not want to win this lottery ever.
Yeah. I'm just going to try and kill you. I don't even care if I win.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just coming at you.
Yeah, and you know, that's actually something to be worried about, too, in EDH, is there are wild cards. There, mm-hmm. And we'll talk about this later, about different kinds of players and play groups, but yeah, you want to be careful. You never know what's going to happen, both in the cards and from the player.
Okay, so another Sun Tzu quote. When you engage in fighting, if victory is long in coming, then men's weapons will grow dull and their spirit will be dampened. If you lay siege to a town, you will exhaust your strength. What this means is, in general, don't commit your forces unless you know victory can be swift.
Yep.
Like, small gains don't do you very much good, and they open you up.
Neither does a long war where both players lose a lot of creatures.
Yeah. You know? In fact, if there's 4 people playing and 2 guys are just going at each other, just throwing everything at each other, the other 2 guys are like,
sweet.
Sweet. Let's just sit here.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just going to gather cards in my hands, play out a few threats, but I'm mostly just going to let those guys, because whoever wins that thing, they're only going to be at a few health, and we'll just...
Yeah, I'll firebolt you.
Yeah, I'll just...
You know?
We'll just finish that guy off and then decide it between the 2 of us. Like,
yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, you're at 2 life? I happen to be at 36. All right, let's play.
Okay,
it doesn't matter how strong your board is. At that point, so many things can kill you. You'll be killed by what I like to call splash damage.
Yep, exactly.
Where, like, you know, like, even if you're just watching, stuff that's just happening in the world is going to smack you in the face a couple of times, and that could be enough.
Yep, exactly. So I think that's it's good to know on both sides. Like, you know, don't start committing forces to an all-out attack on somebody unless you know you can win pretty fast. And if you see other people doing that, let them do it. Don't get involved. Just mm-hmm. let them go at each other. Just clean up, you know, whoever's like deeply wounded at the end and limping away from the battle, then you finish them off.
Yeah, and at that point, you're actually able to make an ally out of them, being like, hey, you're going to die next turn?
Yeah.
All right, I'll make sure you get second place.
Yeah, exactly. And then they can attack the other guy for you, and all of a sudden, yeah, exactly. I like how you think, Jim.
Yeah, honestly, though, anything that gives someone a glimmer of hope as to, it's like, wait, I get to live another turn, they look at their cards in their hand and like, I'll take it.
Yeah.
Because you never know. You know, things could happen in that turn. Hopefully not, but things can always happen.
Exactly. Another Sun Tzu quote. The rising of birds into flight is a sign of an ambush. Startled beasts indicate a sudden attack is coming. So, okay. What this means is that you need to learn to predict who's sort of an imminent threat to you and mm-hmm. who is not.
Yep.
This is where sort of poker tells come in.
Definitely.
Yeah. I've noticed at the table, like, you can tell, like, there's five players at the game, but one player is sort of looking at your cards a lot.
Yeah.
You know, he might be sitting across from you. He might be sitting to your right. But for some reason, when it's not their turn, they're sort of looking at their cards and then looking at your cards on the table, you know, and then they sort of look around, but they keep coming back to your cards. If they're eyeballing your stuff, they're coming at you pretty soon.
Yeah, exactly. And they're, well, literally what exactly is going on in their head is like, okay, I tap for this, and then he'll block with that.
Yes,
they're
exactly.
They're calculating the moves. They're trying to do the four moves ahead, see if they can come out on top.
Exactly. And if they're looking at your stuff while they do it,
yeah.
Dude, they're coming at you, so get ready.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Maybe you need, like, you need to preemptively strike at them to sort of fool their plans before they really get hatched.
Yeah, exactly. Or direct someone else at them. And this is where just general knowledge of the game helps out a lot, and general knowledge of the colors and color combinations too.
Mm-hmm.
You know, knowing what, you know, if it's a red deck, you know, there's going to be something with haste in there. And actually that applies to a lot of decks. If there's a Swift with Boots on the table, you can guarantee that if he casts something that costs one less than to equip it, that thing is going to potentially swing next turn.
Mm-hmm.
So you can actually look at the table and gauge who is a threat based on what's on the table, but you should also always be looking at the colors. You know, if a Prosh deck is there and he can cast Prosh next turn, something bad might happen. You know, it's the ability to do damage and wreak havoc is there.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping a note of that is also really important.
Yeah, I think just the other day we're playing, right? And everyone's, you know, attacking each other in a normal fashion, and one player has like 10-0-1 kobolds on the table. That's
I'm
it.
Like, okay.
Just 10-0-1 kobolds. There's 0-1. So everyone's just sort of ignoring this guy. And then I notice him start to look around, and it's like, oh crap. You know, and then it's his turn, and what's he do? He drops a coat of arms.
Yep.
All his dudes become
+1/+1 for each other creature type that
shows. So they all become like 9-10s or whatever. Then he puts 10 more kobolds out. They're all 19-20s, and he just kills everybody.
Yep.
And it's like, yeah,
that's swift justice.
Yep, exactly. And it's like we should have known that a turn or two before, because he was looking around and like sort of his lips were moving but no sound was coming out. That's that's like he's calculating. He's doing
exactly.
Math in his
head.
Yeah,
you can see the numbers flying past his eyes.
Yeah.
At that point, he didn't even have to have numbers in his eyes. Having 19-20s is enough to kill everyone at the same time.
But we should have seen it coming, and we could have easily killed those kobolds, but you know, we were just so worried about other things. So
pay attention. Also, you know, sometimes people will do things that don't seem like a big threat. If he had 10 literal kobolds of Carekeep cards out, right, then we look at him and be like, oh my goodness. Instead, he has just a single die with
that's
a number
true.
On it.
He has one card with a die on top of it.
Yeah.
You know, that just looks less scary than like 10
much
cards
less.
Laid out, even though they're equivalent. Yeah.
Not to mention the art for that card is just ridiculous. So it doesn't seem threatening ever, really.
They look like little children.
Yeah, they are. They're just having a nice time.
Okay, another Sun Tzu quote. He who wishes to fight must first count the cost. I think we covered this a little bit, but if you have to ask yourself, if you're going to attack, how much are you leaving yourself open?
Yeah.
Not just to the person you're attacking, but to the people you aren't attacking.
Yeah. You're engaged in a world war. You know, there are multiple countries at stake here, and they're all different powers and all different strengths, and they all have all different things that they can do. You have to be worried about everyone, you know, unless you're making allies everywhere. But even then, you know, the only person you can trust at the end of the day is yourself.
Yeah, don't trust your allies 100%.
Ever.
Trust them, you know, depending, 60%, 70%. Yeah, but exactly. Don't ever trust them 100%. They will turn on you.
Yeah.
Okay, so another quote. When we are near, we must make the enemy believe we are far away.
Ah.
So this is sort of the opposite of the poker tell thing.
Yeah.
This is like, don't have tells yourself.
Just don't have tells, really.
Yeah. So if
except for maybe touching your mana when you want to counter something.
Yeah. No, that's a tell that you want everybody to pick up
on. Exactly.
But if you're actually literally able to kill everyone next turn, be really careful.
Yeah.
You know, don't eyeball their cards and mouth, you know, silent math, you know, to yourself. Don't start counting.
Yeah.
You know, if I listen and I hear somebody going like 19, 20, 27, 27, I don't want to hear the number 27.
That's never
ever.
A good number. Yeah. Yeah.
I just don't want to hear anything above like 4.
I don't want to see someone looking at my cards and silently counting them with their fingers either. It's like, he's got 5 guys up. It's like, that's the last thing you want to see.
Yeah. So inversely or conversely, don't do that yourself. Like, if you've got to lay these plans, just be sly about it, because then no one will see it coming.
Yeah. And too often have I seen probably Craig, to be honest, have just the biggest sheepish grin on his face, and it's like, great, Craig wins.
There's an infinite combo coming or something,
or someone's gonna die.
Sun Tzu says, let your plans be dark and impenetrable as night, and when you move, fall like a thunderbolt.
Ah, yes.
Yes. So that I think
so
that,
play red, right?
Thunderbolt.
Perfect.
Lightning bolt. Okay. So let's talk about knowing your playgroup.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like this quote a lot.
This is maybe the most famous quote. Go ahead.
If you know your enemy and know yourself, you need not fear the result of 100 battles.
So that's pretty self-explanatory. Like, learn the personalities in your playgroup.
Yeah.
You know, there's always going to be people. People aren't going to change their personalities from game to game. Like, there's going to be people who are open to negotiating and people who really aren't. There's going to be people who just like to be aggressive. They just like to attack.
Yeah.
There's going to be people who don't like to attack at all, ever. You know, and learn who those people are. And then you can learn the best way to sort of manipulate them into the situations that you want.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, you can appeal to the parts of their personality that help you the most, you know, in any given situation. So if somebody's really aggressive and they don't like to form alliances, then don't try and form alliances with them. Try and get them pointed at somebody else.
Yeah, right. They're a giant cannon they're about to blow. Just, you know.
Yeah, just don't look scary.
Direction.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But if somebody is really scary, but they, you know, usually they're open to like forming alliances and they're pretty trustworthy from past games, you know that about their personality, then that's a person that you can form an alliance with.
Yeah,
and you can be like, hey, listen, I've got this Swords to Plowshares, but I won't use it.
Yeah.
You know, because I know you want to kill this other guy. So we'll just don't look in my direction. I won't look in yours and everybody will be cool, right? And
yeah.
And that
one thing
can work.
One thing I found is really effective is you're allowed to speak out of turn in EDH. You know, something's happening. The guy puts his hand in his head. It's like, I can't do anything about that. Can anyone do anything about that? You shoot your hand up if you want and be like, I have an answer for that. This is what I want.
Yep.
You know, or like, I can maybe do something about that. What can you do for me?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's all about negotiating. And my favorite player personality by far is, I call it the Clint, which is just the wild card.
Yeah, there's always a chaotic neutral.
Yeah, chaotic neutral or just chaotic as far as I'm concerned, where it's just, you know what, I'm just going to go all out and do a full swing on you. I don't care if I die next turn. And oftentimes, chaotic neutral just makes it to second place.
Yeah, because they're not really a threat because you can't predict where they're going to go.
Exactly.
Yeah. That just means if somebody's that type of player, if they're within reach of killing you, you just have to kill them because you can't trust that they
won't.
You can't
trust them. Yeah.
That doesn't mean they will, doesn't mean they won't. You just can't negotiate with that person. So, you know, just know that and you have to handle them correctly.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't mean that that person is ruining the game or anything. They're just another different kind of obstacle that you have to learn how to deal with.
Yeah.
You know? That's another type of thing that I think Spikes complain about is like the, what they call the kingmaker aspect of the game. It's like a person who can't win, but they can decide who wins. It feels like that.
Yeah.
But that's your fault if you're allowing them to decide who wins because you're not exercising your skill as a negotiator, as a manipulator.
You have just as much power as the next person.
Exactly.
To put words in people's heads.
Exactly. You have to use your cunning and your use of, you know, your charisma or whatever to get them to not attack you. And if they do, then you have to take responsibility for that. You know,
correct.
You did something through the game or you acted in some way and they chose you over the other person, you know, and so next game, what can you do differently?
Or even that same game, what can you change up?
Yeah.
You know, you're like, all right, well, if I am the king, then I'm going to start making kingly decisions because I have the power to exert over my minions.
Correct.
You know, you have whatever power is on your board and whatever power you conceal. And it's up
to whatever power
to
the other players grant you.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really the most important part is being able to be a big threat. Or being able to say, like, hey, this person's a huge threat. I don't have any removal spells. You could have four removal spells in your hand. Can someone get rid of this card? And they use their resources, and they use their stuff. And it's like, well, thank you, friendly neighbor nation that has fought my war for me. Great.
That is the best feeling in the world, is when you don't use any of your mana, you don't use any of your cards, you just use your words, and somebody else uses their mana and their cards to get rid of something that you really wanted to get rid of.
Exactly. Maybe you guys both needed to be gotten rid of, right? Maybe it's really bad. It's Elesh Norn. It's giving everyone -2/-2.
Yep.
But it affects you much more than the guy next to you, but that guy gets rid of it for you. Oh, perfect situation.
That is really, I'd say, quintessentially, like, that skill is super important to EDH. It's like using your influence, using your politics to get things accomplished that you would otherwise have to use mana and cards for.
Yeah. Emil, if you play EDH right, you have essentially everyone else's deck at your disposal to a certain degree.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, I think that's actually the next point, which is, you know, pay attention to the cards and decks in your meta and, you know, what their most important components are and, you know, what other things they have. This is like doing your homework. Because this allows you to do things like point out when someone else is about to do something dangerous.
Right.
Like if Niv-Mizzet hits the table and you know, man, there's an Ophidian Eye in that deck. So that could be an infinite combo loop that we can't break if he lands it. And so you just, if you don't know about that combo, it's hard for you to point it out. But if you know, you can be like, guys, That card right there, infinite combo possibility that destroys us all next turn.
Yeah.
So can anybody kill that thing?
Or leave a counter up.
Yeah.
You know, can anyone at least have a response if this does happen?
Because we will literally all lose if he happens to have that card in his hand. You know, if you don't know about that combo possibility, you can't even say the thing because you don't know what to look out for and what to point out.
Exactly. Yeah. It's a great learning experience too. It's like you can piece together what other people are doing the more you know about their cards. And the more you play Commander, the more you'll know, obviously. But you need to, when you read someone else's card, don't just put it away being like, cool, okay, the next time it happens, I'm gonna need to read it again.
Yeah. Try and think about And you know, this goes for like when you get beat. Because it's Commander, you're gonna get beat. People are gonna do big, broken stuff.
Yep.
They're going to, you know, pull out their infinite combo on you. Don't get mad. You're trying to do the same thing.
Yeah.
Your deck is trying to do some big broken combo, whether it's infinite or not. It's trying to do something, you know, trying to abuse something that wasn't necessarily meant to be abused. And when they do that, be like, man, that was cool. Now let me remember what cards that took so I can stop you from doing it next time. But don't get mad. Infinite combos are cool. You're trying to do stuff like that.
Yeah, right?
Yeah. Just try and remember it for future so that you can stop it, or you can put cards in your deck to stop it.
Right.
Or you can at least point it out to the other players at the table, like, it's about to happen. We need the four of us to team up and stop it.
Or you could do all that and then put them into your own deck so that you have the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Why not?
Why not?
Yeah. Another thing is, if somebody plays something dangerous or even that just looks dangerous and isn't, you can use it to deflect aggression from you onto them.
Make plays bigger than they actually are if you have to.
Yeah.
Someone just plays a soul ring. It's like,
Oh, man.
Dude, soul ring turn one? Come on, dude. None of us have a soul ring.
Seriously.
Target on your back.
Yeah, exactly. He's going to be like two turns ahead of everybody. I mean, he could play Polukranos next turn. What are we going
to
do about that?
Oh, my gosh, yeah. Guys, we have to get rid of it.
Yeah.
Just anyone, just do any artifact destruction. It's just one card. It's fine. And at least it'll put us on the even playing ground.
So let's wrap this main topic up. The EDH is pretty unique. You know, it's unique in that your resources are doubled or whatever, because it's not just cards in your hand. It's those aren't the only answers you have to your opponents. You know, normally they play something, it's one-on-one, they play something, and I have to look at my hand and be like, okay, either I have answers in my hand or I don't have any answers. But in EDH, you can look at the other players around you as well. And chances are, you know, if you're currently losing the game, you're not the only one.
Yeah, you're definitely not the only one. In fact, everyone's losing the game at the same time except for one person usually. And as we wrap this up, there's one thing I wanted to mention, which is, and we might do a whole podcast on this later, but the friends that you play with are very important, because they're your friends and they're the ones that are going in on this commitment to play Magic and EDH with you at the same time. So don't do anything that's going to ultimately destroy your play group. You know, don't be that guy that's like, I'm going to go online and Google most broken EDH combos and then just whip all those out, you know, because that's not going to win you any friends outside of the game either.
I mean, you could do it. It's only going to work once or twice, you know, and then literally like everyone's just going to attack you at the start of every game and you're going to be sitting there complaining, being like, why did they gang up on me?
Yeah,
well,
exactly.
You brought it upon yourself. Yeah, I think, you know, also like your gaming group is something that, you know, you need to cultivate, you need to, you know, communicate with, you need to, you know, continue to, you know, you need to treat it like something that needs, you know, it's a commitment. It needs to be.
It needs sun and water. And,
yes, exactly.
You know, good nurturing.
And, you know, people are going to get upset sometimes. People want to win the game. You know, there's politics. They're going to feel betrayed. You know, you said you weren't going to attack me, then you attacked me, you know, stuff like that. And just make sure that after the game, you separate those moments. You know, there's been some times in our play group where, like, people got kind of mad. You know, you have a table lock on the table because of counterspells or Glen Alendra or some other stuff. And then, you know, we've been real careful after the game to be like, hey, man, you know, I was upset during the game, but, you know, it's cool. Like, yeah, I totally get it. Like, make sure you have those conversations. Don't let everybody just walk away and be pissed, you know, and maybe not come back next time or sort of be mad next time. Just let them know. Like, hey, give them beer or, you know, if you're not over 21, don't do that.
Yeah.
Give them a Coke. And
play another game.
Play another game and just talk it out. Just be like, hey, yeah, that was. And, you know, when somebody does something to you and you were upset about it, you know, when everybody's shuffling up for the next game or they're putting all their cards away and they're going home, you know, sit and think about it for a second. Then go up to the dude and be like, you know what? That combo you pulled off, that was pretty cool.
That was pretty cool.
You know, I was trying.
Combos are pretty cool in general.
I like to like think of it from their perspective, you know. If I build a deck, like I'm excited, like I built this thing and I came up with this idea, like, man, if I ever get these four cards out, I'm just going to wipe the whole table. Like this is going to be awesome. And they finally do it and people get mad at them and it's like, come on, man.
You're looking to do the exact same thing with your deck.
Yeah, go up to them and be like, you know what?
Yeah.
That four card infinite combo that just killed everybody on turn, you know, 12 or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
That was awesome.
Yeah, right?
Yeah, that was awesome. I wish my deck would do the same thing. It didn't this game, but maybe next game.
And ultimately, you're going to lose a lot more games of EDH than you're going to win. So just if you keep that mentality in mind, don't get, you know, don't get your feelings hurt if you lose.
still try and win every game. But when you don't get too upset.
Yeah. And this is something, of course, you can talk to your friend group or two, because if someone's just running a $3,000 deck and he's just devastating everyone, even if you do target him, he's still winning, like, you'd be like, hey, man, can you tone it down? Like, for the sake of your friends.
I want to see the deck. I haven't seen one yet that if... I think in a group of three or less, mm-hmm. that could happen. I think in a group of four or more.
Yeah.
And that that variance could be the answer. Like, here's a guy, you put together a really sweet deck, and you only play with three players. You know what you need to do? You need to go find another friend that plays.
Yeah.
And then the three of you can just gang up on that guy at the start of every game. And yeah. I don't... Maybe there's an EDH deck out there. But I think generally that would just mean that the three of you need to work on your decks.
Yeah.
If they can't beat that one guy. Because even with... like so-so cards, three decks should be able to beat one most of the time.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. At the end of the day, communication is key. Make sure you guys are talking to each other. Make sure you don't just let bad feelings simmer around until they, you know, you don't want to sack out your friendships with people.
I like that. I mean, don't do it. I like that wording.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so Commander Spotlight this Let's week. We're going to do Rune of the Hidden Realm.
Yeah, he's a Commander 2013 Commander. He came in the sets that were released last year. Mm-hmm. He is a Bant creature, so he's white, blue, and green, and he costs two colorless on top of that, so a total casting cost of five for a 4/4 vigilance trample. And what does he do?
You tap two mana and you tap rune, and it says exile another target creature, return that creature to the battlefield under its owner's control at the beginning of the next end step. So let's talk about how this works. For one, you can target your own creatures, or you can target someone else's creatures,
as long as they don't have hexproof.
Correct. If they have hexproof, they can't be targeted. And what it does is it exiles them temporarily until the end step.
Right. And if you're new to the game, you might be thinking, what the heck is the point of this? He's like flying away to another realm and coming back? What? I don't get it. Why would you ever do that to a creature?
There's a couple reasons. One is if someone attacks you with the creature, this will cancel out the damage. You do the exiling before the damage is dealt. Mm-hmm. And so that creature goes away to the nether realm or wherever, and it pops back in at the next end step. And when it pops back in, it says if it was just cast. Yep. So it's untapped. Mm-hmm. No other harm has been done to it. So it's
not
on
summoning
defense.
Sick if it's, yeah. it's if it's already been cast the prior turn, though.
Well, it would be technically, but it's coming in at the end step, so right. It doesn't matter.
Right.
So that is a powerful effect on defense. It also can be used to sort of double up what we call enter the battlefield effects,
right?
Or
comes into play
effects. So if you've got a creature, let's just say acidic slime lets you kill a non-creature permanent.
Yeah, target artifact, enchantment, or land.
Correct. Oh, artifact or enchantment or land. So not a planeswalker either.
No planeswalker.
So what you do is you play the acidic slime, you destroy an artifact, enchantment, or land, and then you use rune on him, and he goes out of play, and he comes back at the end step, and then you destroy another enchantment, mm-hmm. artifact, or land. That's very powerful with enter the battlefield effects.
Also, doing this can actually be a form of removal against mm-hmm. counters on creatures and as well as tokens.
Correct.
Because when tokens are exiled, they don't go to a mysterious realm and come back. They sort of fizzle into thin air. And if your guy has counters on them, when he comes back, any +1/+1 counters or -1/-1 counters are now gone.
Correct. So it's sort of hitting the reset button on a creature, which can be really helpful. Mm-hmm. Also, if they have enchantments on them, those enchantments are gone.
Right.
So if somebody's...
Artifacts become unequipped.
Correct. So there's a lot of uses... for the flicker effect. One thing I want to point out is it does say, it says, exile another target creature, return that creature to the battlefield under its owner's control at the beginning of the next end step. So owner's control. So if someone has stolen one of your creatures with a control magic mm-hmm. or any other effect that takes that creature, you can flicker it out with rune. You can tap two. We call it flickering when they leave the battlefield and come back.
Yeah, it's like turning the light on and off.
Yep. So you can exile it with rune, and it'll come back under play under its owner's control. So whoever owns that card, whoever bought and paid for that card or traded for it or whatever, gets it back. So this is a way to sort of give back permanents that have otherwise been stolen.
Yeah.
But also, if you've stolen somebody else's creature...
Don't flicker it.
Don't flicker it, because that'll give it back to them.
Unless there's something that is very conditional. But for the most part, yeah.
And also, you can use this as sort of a group hug style thing, where somebody, let's say player B, stole mm-hmm. player C's creature, and it's neither of them are your creatures, and neither of them, you know, you didn't do the stealing, and you didn't get stolen from. But it doesn't matter. You can be like, hey, dude, you want your creature back?
Yeah.
What are you going to do for me?
Yep.
You know, you can make those kind of deals. It's good to have effects on the battlefield that you, if you choose to, you don't have to, but if you choose to, you can use it to help other people. You can also, like, somebody's attacking somebody else that's not you, and it's, like, going to do a lot of damage and maybe kill them. You can be like, I can save you.
I can save you, yeah. I'll flicker him out. I'll get room for a turn.
If I save you, you know, will you just go at them with everything you got next turn?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. You can also use it not just when someone's attacking you, but when you're defending someone and you don't want your creature to die, and it has an enter the battlefield effect. It's like, all right, well, I'll assign him as a blocker. Before combat damage is assigned, he gets flickered out. I don't take any damage. He comes back in, and I get the added bonus of whatever that card is, and your guy's tapped out.
That is a great point. Okay, so
let's take advantage of.
Flicker is really fun. Well, let's talk about some mechanics to abuse here. So enter the battlefield, creatures with enter the battlefield, or what we call 187 creatures, so creatures that kill other creatures when they come into play.
I haven't heard that before.
Yeah, on that line, we've got what's called the duplicate.
Yes, duplicate is one of my favorite artifact creatures. He's a 6-drop that when he comes into the battlefield, you can exile target permanent, and then duplicate sort of basically becomes a soft copy of it. It doesn't gain the abilities on it, but it gets the power toughness and the creature types.
Correct. It only exiles a non-token creature.
Non-tokens, right.
This is a great card because exile is very powerful.
Yeah, you don't want to be exiling tokens with duplicate anyway.
Yeah, exactly. You could just exile it with rune, flicker it out, and they don't come back.
Yep, forever.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, duplicate's amazing.
Yeah.
Anytime I can find a way to recur him, I do it every time because it's incredible. It's spot removal. You can just put him into play for a relatively cheap cost for what he's doing, and you get a creature, and you get to just exile something big and nasty and destructive.
And you can just do it again and again because as long as duplicate's out on the table and you have a way to flicker him, you're just offing a creature, you know, every turn or so. So it's super powerful. Plus, yeah, he actually can get bigger depending on what it is, and it's exile. You know, that's really powerful. You can even get rid of Avacyn, you know, who's indestructible with that. So
yeah, you can actually do anything that's indestructible really with that.
Yeah, the only thing you couldn't touch is Hexproof stuff again because it is targeted.
Correct. Yeah, and also there are cards that have leave the battlefield effects that are really effective.
Yeah.
Not as many as enter the battlefield effects.
But leave the battlefield can actually be even more effective because if you read Rune, it says it brings the creature back during the next end step. So you can't time it specifically. So if your creature was, say, acidic slime and you wanted to get rid of one of their lands, you'd have to wait till their end step to get rid of it. It wouldn't do it at the moment that you flickered it. It'd do it at the moment that the creature comes back into play.
Right.
But if you have, say, let's say, Nevermaker, when Nevermaker leaves play, put target non-land permanent on top of its owner's library. So that's at the moment that you flicker it, when it goes out, not when it comes in. So you can actually do this at a crucial moment. You know, you need. They attack you, and they have an artifact that's giving all their creatures. Let's say it's making all their kobolds into 1920s.
Right, coat of arms.
Yes. So they attack you full out. Well, what do? You flicker your Nevermaker out. It leaves play, and you take the coat of arms, which is the artifact.
Yep.
And you put that on top of their library, and now all their creatures are back down to zero ones.
Yeah. And they have to draw it again.
Yeah.
They know what card they're going to draw next turn, then they're inevitably probably going to play it.
Yeah, but it gave you a turn. If you had a acidic slime in that same spot, it doesn't help you because you can remove acidic slime from the game, you're going to take a gajillion damage, and then you're not even going to be alive during your end step for him to come back in and kill that coat of arms.
Yeah, exactly.
So look for leave the battlefield effects. Thragtusk is another good one.
Right.
Thragtusk is awesome because he actually gives you both. So when he enters the battlefield, he gives you 5 life, and when he leaves the battlefield, he gives you a 3/3.
Yeah, exactly.
So what you do is you get, if you do that 3 or 4 times, you gained 15 or 20 life and gotten like
a bunch of beasts.
So it anything that does both, has a leave the battlefield and an enter the battlefield effect, is super powerful.
Including Angel of Serenity.
Yeah.
Which is a lot of fun because you can use this also defensively. If someone has Angel of Serenity, one of your favorite guys, and you need him this turn, well, you know what? I'm going to just, during my turn, use Rune to pop him out. I get those cards back.
Correct.
And now I can actually use them again.
Yep. But also, you can use your own Angel of Serenity, and it doesn't exile him, but it pops him back to their hand when she leaves play.
Yep.
So if you have a way to repeatedly flicker her out, you can just start popping everybody's creatures 3 at a time back to their hand. It's very hard to keep up with that.
Yeah, exactly.
You just don't have enough mana to keep playing all your threats back out. And you're going to probably, you know, you have a good chance of winning that in short order. There's a lot of other cards with Enter the Battlefield effects. There's a ton. We're not going to go through all of them. Let's talk about another kind of creature. It's what I call a creature that benefits from the owner reset.
Yes.
Or just resets in general. So we talked a lot about Glen Alendra last podcast, so we won't go too deep into her, but let's just say you play out Glen Alendra, you can sacrifice her to counter a spell.
She comes back.
She comes back with a -1/-1 counter. You flicker her out, she comes back, and the -1/-1 counter is gone.
Yep, so she's now brand
you
new.
So now you can use her again. She'll come back with a -1/-1 counter, and you can keep doing it. So normally Glenn Alendra, you could just use her twice, but if you have Rune, you can use her theoretically an infinite amount of times.
Yeah. Yeah, as long as someone doesn't get rid of Glenn Alendra, but for the most part, she can counter whatever you're trying to get rid of her with. So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. There's not going to be a non-creature spell that kills her, probably, you know.
And it's also good to note that having Glenn Alendra up, you know, the timing of when you use Rune is also very important, because you wouldn't want to be like, all right, at the beginning of your turn, I'm going to flicker Glenn Alendra. It's like, all right, well, she's gone for the whole turn. You can't counter anything they do. You want to do it, you know, before end steps.
Correct. Yeah, actually, that's a really good point. Is the way you usually will play Rune is you'll let the person go through their turn, and then they go, okay, I passed my turn. And you go, wait, before your end step, I'm going to flicker this thing. And then during your end step, it's going to come back. So right. To the table, it doesn't really go anywhere because it's only gone for that little small instant.
Right. But you get to, you know, reset your characters. You
your
get
Thragtusk.
Yeah, right, your Thragtusk or whatever.
Yeah. Another creature that benefits from what we call an owner reset is the Gilded Drake. The Gilded Drake is a 3/3 flyer. It costs 2 mana, blue and a colorless. And when Gilded Drake comes into play, exchange control of Gilded Drake for target creature one of your opponent controls. Or sacrifice Gilded Drake, which you're not going to do because that'd be stupid. So
yeah, definitely not.
What you do is you play it, and then you say, I want your Avacyn, and you can have my Gilded Drake. Have fun.
Have fun.
And then, before the end step, you use Rune, and you flicker out that Gilded Drake.
It comes back
to play under the owner's control. And it's just come into play, so you can exchange it for another creature. And you go, oh, and I want your Jaleva. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes, and you can take my Gilded Drake. And then at the next end step, I'll do it again. And
right. If
you get Gilded Drake and enough flicker effects, you can basically steal everybody's stuff at the table.
You're not going to make any friends, but at that point, hopefully that's that sort of one card turn combo that you've done that has, you know, hopefully destroyed the game and lets you win.
It'll definitely make it tough for you to deal with. Or people will just be scared, like, don't take my stuff. Okay, don't attack me.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't even care about you. I just want to get this guy because he did damage with a 2/2 cat soldier token to me earlier.
Right. Or really, I just want Avacyn because of Avacyn.
Yeah. Okay, so another creature that is really powerful with the owner reset is the Perplexing Chimera.
Yes, I actually had rules questions about this. So if you could explain this card, that would be great.
Okay, so the Perplexing Chimera, what it does is it sits there on the battlefield. You play it out. It's a 3/3 for 5 mana. And it says, whenever an opponent casts a spell, you may exchange control of Perplexing Chimera and that spell. If you do, you may choose new targets for the spell.
Oh, wow. Look at that.
So a spell is basically any card except for a land.
Yep.
So let's say they play an artifact and you don't want them to have that, or you want it. You go, okay, I'm going to give you Perplexing Chimera in exchange for that.
Nice.
And you just take the artifact, and now it's basically the same as if you cast it.
Yeah.
You're in control of it.
Blightsteel Colossus.
Yep.
Something
it's
huge.
Yours.
Yep.
Yep. It's yours. And even if it has hexproof, it doesn't matter because it's still a spell on the stack. It's not, none of its abilities as a creature are active yet.
Right. And Perplexing Chimera never says target.
Correct. So then what would normally happen is they have the Perplexing Chimera, and now they can do the same thing to somebody else when they cast a spell.
Right.
But you can use Rune, and you can flicker it out, and it comes back under owner's control. So you get the Perplexing Chimera back. And now if anybody else casts a spell, let's say they cast a dragon, and you're like, I want that dragon. I'll trade you my Perplexing Chimera for it. And now you have a dragon and whatever cool artifact you stole, and then you can flicker it again. So it's very, very powerful. It makes people not want to play spells. Now, the only thing, there's a few things that get rid of Perplexing Chimera. One would be like a Wrath Effect.
Mm-hmm. Destroys everything.
Because you can take control of the Wrath Effect and give them your Perplexing Chimera. But doesn't matter.
Or you could just
everything's getting wrathed.
You could bounce your Perplexing Chimera in response to the wrath and let everything else die and have that.
Yeah, I mean, you need some sort of bounce effect. Yeah, Perplexing Chimera protects against most things, but a wrath effect will get rid of it.
Yeah,
because it doesn't matter who's in control of the
Rune
wrath
can bounce them out.
That's true. You could bounce them out. You could, you could flicker them. But then, yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Okay.
So another thing to note is unless you have a way of untapping Rune and having enough mana to do it every single time, this is sort of a once per round effect.
Correct. Rune himself only allows you to flicker one time.
Correct.
So what do we want? We want more cards that flicker things because we're going to build a deck full of stuff that wants to be flickered. We want a bunch of other things that flicker things. And like it's like we talked about last week, how I don't want to be in a situation where I don't have my commander out and I have no chance to win.
Yep.
So there's a lot of other cards that actually duplicate Rune's effect.
Yep.
Let's talk about the... Go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say one of my favorites is just straight up Flicker Wisp, which is a great card, and it's one of those uncommons that's actually worth money. It's like a dollar uncommon. It's a 3-drop flying 3/1. When Flicker Wisp comes into play, remove another target permanent from the game, return that card to play under its owner's control at end of turn. So basically what Rune does, but with a creature that does it when it enters the battlefield, right. In this case, comes into play.
So it's a one-time flicker use effect. So you can use it just like Rune. So if you have Glen Elendra out, you could flicker, she comes back with no counters, and then you didn't have to use Rune to tap. You know, you could still have them available for somebody else's end step.
You could grab your Perplexing Chimera back. Mm-hmm. You could do a lot of things with it. And ultimately, it's 3 mana for a 3/1 flying.
Yeah,
and
so it's still,
that's pretty good.
Yep, it's a real threat that's on the table that, you know, people are going to have to deal with eventually. Mm-hmm. The Miss Meadow Witch is one of my favorites. It's one hybrid blue-white. So the hybrid blue-white is one of those mana that you can either play a blue or a white, and then it's one colorless.
Right.
And it's
so
a
1/1
Kithkin Wizard. And its ability is you tap two colorless, a white and a blue, and then you exile target creature, return that card to the battlefield under its owner's control at the beginning of the next end step. So it's the exact same ability as Rune, except for two things. It costs 4 mana instead of 2, but you don't have to tap the Miss Meadow Witch to do it.
Yep.
That's very powerful. It means you have 8 mana. You can do it twice. And the Miss Meadow Witch can flicker itself where Rune cannot.
Right.
So the Miss Meadow Witch can protect itself.
Right.
The Miss Meadow Witch is probably actually the best card in the deck.
Yeah.
So
it's such a universal ability. Anytime you don't see the tap symbol, you've got something.
Exactly. You got 12 mana. You can do it 3 times.
Yeah, exactly.
You can start getting pretty crazy once you have the Miss Meadow Witch on the table with quite a bit of mana. So that's another one. And then
Conjurer's Closet, which is a rare that's been printed 4 times now, I guess. So it's a 5-drop, and it says at the beginning of your end step, you may exile target creature you control, then return that card to the battlefield under your control.
So it's basically a free flicker once it's out on the table.
Yeah. And it does it at the best time
often,
which is at the end step when you want to be doing it.
Yep. So that's a really good one, too, because it's just guaranteed once per turn for no additional mana, you flicker something out and back in. So let's say you have a Moldrifter.
Moldrifter.
A great card that it draws. When it comes to the battlefield, you draw 2 cards. It's
great.
Two flyer.
You know, it's great in Limited, and it's okay in EDH when you can only play it once.
Yeah, but it's awesome when you can repetitively use it to enter the battlefield.
Yeah,
when you
exactly.
Can use it. So if you have the Conjurer's Closet and a Moldrifter out, you're just drawing 2 cards for free every turn, 2 extra cards.
Yep. And you can make that even more if you wanted to, you know, ruin it up.
Right.
She pops in at the, or he, I guess, I have no idea what gender the Moldrifter is.
I don't either.
It pops in at the end of your end step, and then you have a whole another round of turns where you get to do it once before. Or, you know, leaving rune up is a great political decision.
Yep.
Because it's like, well, do you want to do that? Because I can do this in response. I've got the mana and the ability to do so. And I can do it multiple times because I've got multiple things I can do it. So, you know, you got all these options, which is great.
And, you know, if you don't use it to help anybody else out or defend yourself, you just use it to draw cards or destroy a non-creature permanent or you know, whatever else you've got on the table. Thragtusk, gain 5 life and make a 3/3 token.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just use that before your end step. So you sort of can make those decisions as you need to make them.
Exactly.
This is what we call a toolbox deck. A toolbox deck is a deck that has like a lot of different tools because there are so many creatures that have enter the battlefield effects. You can basically find a creature that has an enter the battlefield effect that can work in every situation.
Yeah.
They destroy enchantments, they destroy artifacts, they destroy lands, they destroy creatures, they exile creatures. There's all kinds of effects that the creatures can give you. They bring lands into play. You know, there's all kinds of things you can find. And so the question Or the problem you're going to run into is having the right creature at the right moment that has the effect you want. And the way that you've solved this is you have tutors. So there are some good tutors that are specific to this deck.
So Fauna Shaman is one that I like a lot. It's 2 mana, 1/1 and a green. It's just a creature. It's an elf shaman that you can tap a green and then tap it. And you discard a creature card, search your library for a creature card, reveal it, and put it into your hand. Then shuffle your library. A lot of good things about this card. 1, cheap. 2, put it into your hand.
Yep.
That's great. Anytime something goes into your hand instead of the top of the library, that is immediate card advantage.
It's awesome too because it's just like you can go find any creature. It costs you 1 green mana. Mm-hmm. You have to discard a creature from your hand to do it is the only downside. But what you're doing effectively is you're like, I have a creature in my hand, but I need to get rid of enchantment. So this creature doesn't do that. I'm going to discard it and I'm going to go find an acidic slime or a War Priest of Thune, something that has when it enters the battlefield, destroy target enchantment on it, so I can go find the tool that I need for the job that's in front of me right now.
Yep.
There's a card called Survival of the Fittest. This is only if you have deeper pockets.
Actually, there is a budget version that I can talk about in a second.
Okay.
That's the gold border version.
Oh, yes. True. So Survival of the Fittest, the regular version is more expensive, but it's an enchantment, and it costs one green. It does the same thing as the Fauna Shaman. So you tap a green, and you discard a creature card, and you search your library for any creature card, put it into your hand.
Yeah.
The thing that's good about Survival of the Fittest, besides the fact that it's an enchantment and harder to kill, is that it doesn't tap when you do
it.
So and
you can do
it two or three times.
And you can do it as soon as you play it as well.
Correct.
There's a reason it's an expensive card. It's because it's awesome. There's not as much enchantment removal, and you don't have to tap it. So you don't have to give it haste to do it the first turn. You can just do it immediately, which is pretty impressive. Another one that is definitely a staple of EDH is the Worldly Tutor. Just one of the wisest dudes I've ever seen. You search your library for a creature card, reveal that card to all players, and you put on top of your library after you shuffle your library. And it just costs one, which is great.
Elad Amri's Call is another. It's a green-white. Search your library for a creature card, reveal that card, and put it into your hand. Then shuffle your library. Another really good tutor. Basically does the same thing as Worldly Tutor, but goes into your hand instead of top of your deck.
Right. And it fits the colors. It costs one more. And honestly, paying that one more for it to go into your hand is worth it every time. And that's actually about the same price as a Worldly Tutor, too, which is great.
Yeah. So they're both you know, not super cheap, but they're affordable.
Yeah, yeah. Again, it's like being able to fetch is so important in EDH and even more important in a toolbox because it's like, hey, you know, you're trying to unscrew something with a Phillips head, but it really needs a flathead.
That's
go find
a good
that
analogy.
Flathead, you know?
Yep. Go find the flathead. Okay, let's talk about card draw. Last week, I think we went through why we like card draw. You know, when I build a deck, I like to have at least 10 instances of card draw in the deck. So 1 in 10 cards is going to draw me more cards because it's just in EDH for consistency, your deck needs a lot of card draw.
Yeah, you want card draw because you're going through a 100-card deck and there's no 4 of anything.
And card draw is the one thing where if you draw an opening hand and it's not great but it has some card draw in it, then it's okay because you can draw into a good hand.
Yeah,
if you draw a starting hand and it's not great and there's no card draw in it also, it's like, I'm going to draw one card a turn and try and solve this. It's not going to happen.
Yeah.
So we already talked about Mole Drifter, which draws us cards. What else we got?
Coiling Oracle. I didn't even realize this card existed. The beauty about decks like Rune and Toolbox decks is that you don't need to have all the baller money rares to make a deck like this work. Coiling Oracle is simple. It's just when it comes into play, reveal the top card of your library. If it's a land card, put it into play. Otherwise, put that card into your hand.
Yeah, this card is really great because it's also
fantastic.
Ramp.
Yeah, it's ramp and card draw at the same time for 2 mana.
What we should say is ramp is when you're ahead on mana more than like your 1 land per turn.
Right.
So Soul Ring is ramp. Anything that gets you so that on turn 4 I actually have 5 mana available to me rather than 4 mana available to me.
And green is by far the best color to do this in. Yep. Everything is about exploding, cultivating, far-seeking, and reaching into your deck and grabbing lands and putting them into play. So Coiling Oracle is great because it allows you to also, you know, it's there's nothing better than being like, hey, cool, free land play. I get to play 2 lands this turn because of a Coiling Oracle.
And if you don't get the land, then you get to draw that card. Yep. So either way, you're a card ahead. There's also Elvish Visionary. It's 2 mana for a 1/1, and when it comes into play, you draw a card. It's not an expensive card. It's a very cheap card. But you know, it has when you can use Rune to continuously flicker it. So for 2 mana, you're just drawing a card every turn. It's perfectly serviceable. It's a good card in the deck.
Yeah, and not just Rune will be flickering it. A lot of other things hopefully will be flickering it. And it's also important to note that it is a cheap card. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't make a deck that's all just 20 drops, 8 drops, 10 drops that are just the coolest, biggest, baddest creatures you own because you're only going to get to play them turn 8, turn 10. And having an Elvish Visionary on turn 1 is great. You get another card that turn, and you're automatically doing slightly better than everyone else.
Correct. Okay, so that's just some examples of card draw. There's a lot of cards that have entered the battlefield effects that deal with card draw. So let's talk about ramp. There's cards that can give you ramp. There's something called the Farhaven Elf. And what the Farhaven Elf does, it's 3 mana for a 1/1. And when it comes into play, you search your library for a basic land card and put it into play tapped. So this is actually fixing in addition to ramp.
Right.
So you get 1 extra land in play a turn earlier than you would, and you can go find a specific land type. Now, it has to be basic land, but, you know, if you need another island, you go get an island.
Yeah, it's very important to note that cards that say base, search your library for a basic land type, is they're awesome, because it means that, like, hey, you know, maybe your opening hand didn't have, you only had two of your colors, but you also had this card in your hand, which means that, okay, I don't need to worry about necessarily drawing that land because I have a way to fetch it. Another card that does that is Pilgrim's Eye. It's an artifact creature for 3, and it's flying 1/1. When it enters the battlefield, you may search your library for a basic land card, reveal it, and put it into your hand and shuffle your library. Not as good as putting it into play tapped, but still pretty great because you can fix. And it's a flyer, so if you ever need a chump blocker to block and then, you know, flicker them out and do it again, it's awesome.
And, you know, you're going to miss land drops sometimes. You're not just going to have a land to play every turn. So, you know, sometimes you're just going to want to go get that land and keep playing a land every turn. So, and it's card advantage. It's also card draw. You know, both of those cards are technically card draws. It's just you drew a land, but, you know, sometimes you need land. So
the nice thing, too, about this deck is that because you have so many different utility creatures on the board, you know, all sort of parts of your toolbox are being represented, it's really hard for people to, you know, because a lot of EDH decks run single spot removal, where it's like, I want to just get rid of this giant guy. So it's a kill one thing. And if you have 5 different things on the table and all of them do really effective things, either searching for lands or grabbing, you know, more, getting you more mana, it's really hard for an opponent to choose and kill the one that's most effective, because really they're all effective. Yeah, and that's true synergy.
Okay, so let's talk about some cards that you might not think of.
Ah, yes.
Aura Shards, one of my favorite. It says when a creature comes into play under your control, you can destroy target artifact or enchantment. So what's... Nice. The way this is going to work, it's not just when you play creatures from your hand. It's also when you flicker them out, because then they come into play at the beginning of the next end step. That counts. That triggers Aura Shards.
Yeah.
Aura Shards is devastating in this deck, because you can very easily get to a point where, like, you just destroy every enchantment and artifact that's going to come out from your opponents on the entire table.
Yeah, and artifact destruction is so important in Commander. Because
enchantments, too. It's just hard to get rid of them.
Yeah.
It's scary, too, because it's just like, I can have this card, and what if there's no enchantment out, which happens sometimes.
Right.
You know, but with Aura Shards, like, it just sits there on the table and just waits to be used as soon as somebody does. And it works on artifacts, too, so it's a brutal card.
Yeah, definitely. Another great card is Cathar's Crusade, which is just a 5-drop enchantment. Whenever a creature enters the battlefield under your control, put a +1/+1 counter on each creature you control.
Super. It's hard to understand how like
powerful
this is. But let's say you have 4 creatures on the table, and you flicker out 2 of them. They both come into play. They both put 2 tokens on all your creatures.
Mm-hmm.
Now you flicker out another
one. Including itself.
Correct, including itself. Now you flicker out another one. It loses its tokens, but then it puts a 1 token on every other creature, including itself.
Yeah.
A card that works really good with Cathar's Crusade is Glenlendra.
Definitely.
Because what happens is you sacrifice her. She dies. She has Persist. She comes back with a -1/-1 counter. Cathar's Crusade gives her a +1/+1 counter for coming into play, and all your creatures a +1/+1 counter.
Mm-hmm.
So now she's got no counters on her, because the -1 and the +1 cancel each other out. With Cathar's Crusade out and Glenlendra, you can essentially counter unlimited amount of non-creature spells as long as you have the blue mana for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Another creature that works really good with Cathar's Crusade is a card called Fathom Mage.
Ah, I like Fathom Mage.
Yeah, whenever you put a +1/+1 counter on it, you draw a card. Which means now I can flicker out my acidic slime, I can kill an enchantment, an artifact, or a land, and when it comes back into play, I can draw a card because it'll put a counter on all my creatures, including Fathom Mage.
Yeah.
Yeah, super powerful.
It's pretty awesome. Strionic Resonator, too, is a super cheap card that is great. You get to pay 2 and tap it, and you get to copy a target triggered ability.
Yeah, so basically any of your enter the battlefield effects, you just copy it. You do it twice.
Yep.
So if you have Moldrifter now, you flicker it out. For 2 more mana, you draw 2 more cards.
Mm-hmm.
It's that's a great one.
Yeah, and there's one card here that it's funny because Josh wrote up the document and says cards you might not think of, but it's literally the first card I think of whenever you say the 2 colors that this card is in, and that's the Prophet of Kruphix.
I only said cards you may not think of because it doesn't actually have anything to do with flickering.
It's very true. It's very true.
Prophet of Kruphix, we mentioned it last week. We'll probably mention it every single time that green and blue are the colors of the commander. But
even not, I'll mention it when I want Prophet of Kruphix to be in the colors just for its effect.
It's super powerful. On everybody else's turn, you untap all your lands
during
and creatures
upkeep.
During their upkeep, and all your creatures have flash.
Yeah.
So this does a lot of things for this deck, even though it doesn't have to do with flickering. For one, you just need to be able to use mana on other people's turns. For 2, Rune untaps now
every
turn.
Single turn, yeah.
And your mana untaps, so you can basically get additional flickers that you couldn't otherwise do.
Mm-hmm.
For 3, your creatures have flash. So now they can come into play and activate their enter the battlefield abilities as instants, which is really powerful. Like Duplicant, which we talked about earlier, exiles a creature. You use it as an instant removal spell now.
Yeah.
an instant exile removal spell.
Yeah, and for two more, you can do it twice in that same turn because you can, you know, flicker them one way or the other.
Yeah, exactly. And we talked earlier about how much more powerful instant is in EDH because people do this thing where they all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you know, put together something that's going to kill you. Yep. And you're not going to be able to wait until your turn to respond. They're going to do it right now. And so if you have an instant, is a lot of times the only chance you have to stop those things from happening. So,
and I'd say most really effective combos take anywhere from 3 to 5 cards. Mm-hmm. And usually removing one of those will, you know,
set them back a long way.
Exactly. It's like a triangle. If you remove one of the points, it just sort of falls flat. You know, exactly. You can't do it without all 3 of the cards. So being able to do that removal at instant speed is amazing. And also the colors that this deck is in allow you options to do that as well with swords and with counterspells and so many different options. So this deck is definitely great in being able to respond to stuff just immediately, especially if you can get the right pieces out.
Yeah, that's why it's called a toolbox deck. The last card I want to mention that you may not think of is a card called Genesis. Not a necessarily a really, really cheap card, not super expensive, but what Genesis does, well, the thing that does this important is if Genesis is in your graveyard, at the beginning of your upkeep, you pay 3 mana and you can take any creature card from your graveyard and put it into your hand.
Yep.
So any of your creatures that have gone to the graveyard have died. If Genesis is in your graveyard, you can get any of them back for 3 mana.
Yeah.
So this is really powerful with Fauna Shaman, with Survival of the Fittest. The first card you probably want to go get is Genesis.
Yeah.
And then you want to do it again and discard Genesis and go get another creature that you want.
Exactly. And there are a lot of cards that will get removed one way or another. If you have to block something, you know, you're going to have to chump block it. And let's say you don't have the mana to flicker it out and save it. It's okay. You're going to have ways to recur those from your graveyard. And Genesis is probably one of the most solid ways of doing it because
it really is.
He's in your graveyard. Unless someone's going to run Graveyard Hate, which people do in EDH and Commander, you should be able to pull them off pretty often.
Yeah.
Because people have better things to do than to get rid of single cards in your graveyard that aren't going to kill them in one turn.
Okay, so let's talk about some cards that seem like they're good but maybe aren't as good. The first cards I would say are like single use flickers.
Yeah, instant sorceries.
Yeah, so one I've got here is called Turn to Mist. It's an instant, remove target creature from the game, return that card to play under its owner's control at end of turn. So basically does what Rune does, but it does it once.
At first glance, it's like, oh, cool, I'll definitely put this in my deck. It does what I want to do. In case I need to do it, I can do it again. But there are going to be better cards for that value to put in your deck that is literally just a better card that you can be used more than once. Anything that can be used more than once that costs even more mana than 2 is going to be more effective.
Exactly, because in EDH, we're not quite as worried about things like the cost of the spell. Mm-hmm. You know, we want to be able to use it more than once.
Exactly.
Yeah.
There's another one called Ghostly Flicker, which is 2 in the blue, and it's exile 2 target artifacts, creatures, and or lands you control, then return those cards to the battlefield under your control. Now, this is cool because it can target more things, not just creatures, and it's like artifacts and lands, which is unusual. But the thing is, in these colors, there aren't really lands that are going to do much for you.
An artifact creature, but you can already bounce that.
Right, exactly. And being able to do it to 2 things seems like it's better, but at the same time, unless you specifically have a combo piece, right, that requires 2 things to go out at the exact same time and come back, it's just not worth it.
Yeah.
You know, there are better instances. You know, I would gladly put a counter spell in here than this any day of the week.
I think if you put those cards in your deck, you need to put some cards like Archaeomancer or Mnemonic Wall, which go and get instants or sorceries from your graveyard and put them back in your hand. Because it's just not worth it to run cards that you're just going to one-off.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
You want to be able to reuse them. So another type of creature or another type of card that may seem really good but maybe isn't as good is there's a lot of cards that sort of bounce your own things.
Right, putting them back to your hand.
Yes, it feels good, like that's the kind of thing you would want to do is like, oh, I'm going to play my Acidic Slime, I'm going to kill an artifact, and then, you know, I'm going to use this card to put that card back in my hand, then I'm going to cast it again. But that you're just using a really expensive way to do the same thing that Rune does for cheap.
Right. Right.
Yeah. So, and you're going to find like, man, that's going to cost so much mana that I'm not going to be able to do it very often.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I can't do it like during their turns, which is a really important thing. I can't do things like block and then flicker.
Yeah.
Like it's just really tough to pull it off. Now, I might have a couple of these effects in my deck because there's a few cards I might want to, they don't work as good flickering. There's a card called Mystic Snake. Mystic Snake comes into play and it counters a spell.
Yeah.
And then it's a 2/2 creature. And so now if you flicker it out, it won't work as a counterspell again.
Right.
So you do want that card back into your hand. So there's a few cards. So maybe you want one way or two ways to sort of repetitively bounce things when you want to.
Yeah. But you have to actively think, like, if you're going to be like, okay, cool, I'm going to make my deck half this and half that, you know, every card that you do that takes away from the synergy is literally just taking away from the synergy. Even though you're creating new pockets of synergy other places, it's almost like you're growing a tree that's separate to the one that you're doing. And I like to think of EDH decks as trees. You know, you start off with a really central idea, and then things spawn off from that. You know, it's all the branches of the trees. They all do different things. And this deck is about flickering. It's not about enter the battlefield necessarily, because a lot of cards are leave the battlefield. They have other purposes to them. It's about flickering. And so putting a card back in your hand and playing it is not necessarily flickering. It's like really slow mana draining flickering that's very conditional. So, you know, you don't want to focus too much on it. But a card like Mystic Snake is incredible. But it's
it
not
still
as,
belongs in the deck.
It's it still belongs in the deck.
Yeah, and maybe you have one or two ways to sort of bounce things back to your own hand, you know, but don't go all in on unsummon your own stuff effects. Another creature type that I sort of I tend to avoid with this type of deck is something that creates a token when it comes in. It feels good. Like there's Seller of Songbirds. It creates a 1/1 bird creature with flying when it enters the battlefield, and then it's like, oh, I'm gonna flicker it, I'm gonna make another 1/1 bird creature with flow. There's some that make 4/4 angels, you know, that feels good too, but this deck is not gonna win through attacking and blocking. That's not how it's gonna do it. What it's gonna do is gonna lock everybody out at some point. It's gonna just have so much reoccurring, you know, repetitive effect that nobody can really, you know, pull off anything of any importance. And then you're just going to finish them off. And that's mostly how this deck's going to work. You're probably not going to get to the point where you have like 17 4/4 angels because you flickered that guy so many times.
Yeah.
You know, that's just not really going to work. Because in order to make that strategy work, you'd need to be able to, you know, duplicate your tokens,
pump them.
You know, that's, you again, it's like you said, that's a different trunk.
Yeah. It's a whole different deck that you can build around that.
So don't get caught in the trap of enter the battlefield, make a token effects. You want toolbox type effects.
Yeah.
You know, stuff that deals with the threats out on the table that are maybe going to come at you. It's really, at its heart, it's more controlly. It's a more of a control deck.
So let's talk about countering this deck and how you beat it. Because the first time I played this deck, I was like, ah, you're harmless. You know, you're playing the political game, you're just bouncing things back and forth, and then you won. And then I went, wait, hold on. No, well, that I could have had that game. We played another one, you still won. I was like, okay, what's going on here? In an instant, I was like, this deck is unbeatable. This deck is broken. And then clearly, always ways to stop things. Yeah, this is Magic the Gathering. It's never as one-sided as you may think.
There's one card that actually sort of completely shuts down this deck. It's called the Torpor Orb. You want to go ahead and read it?
Yeah, it's a 2-drop for an artifact. Creatures entering the battlefield don't cause abilities to trigger.
Creatures entering the battlefield don't cause abilities to trigger. This is like... It's a big off switch for the whole deck.
Yeah, right?
Because none of your guys have... Just basically all their text is blank. Because they don't have any enter the battlefield.
It pretty much pulls the rug under everyone, including the guys that get rid of cards like Torpor Orb can't even do it because it stops them from doing it.
Yep, exactly. Because your answer in the deck is usually going to be a creature that says when it enters the battlefield, destroy target artifact.
Right.
Well, it doesn't have any enter the battlefield. Yeah. So that card... is definitely super powerful. It's actually a pretty good card to run in your commander deck in general, because usually people are going to have a few creatures.
Right.
You know, they're going to run Angel Serenity. They're going to run... There's a lot of creatures they're going to run that just... They're not going to flicker them. They're just going to get additional value out of them, and you're going to turn all those creatures off.
Yeah, especially if your creatures don't benefit from Enter the Battlefield effects and stuff, then you should... You know, at least have Torpor Orb in your quote unquote sideboard or cards that you like to play in case you know you're going up against a deck like yours, you know?
Yeah, I would also say that, like, the thing is, if you have a couple creatures with Enter the Battlefield effects, you can still put Torpor Orb in your deck.
Definitely.
Because if they're ever in your hand, you're just like, I'll play my creature first and then I'll play Torpor Orb. Like, I'm in control of it.
Yep.
So it's a pretty powerful card. I hate to say that because I don't want more of them out there, like, being used, but I think it's useful as a card. And you know, if you put it in a deck where you can go and tutor it up somehow, then, you know, it kills this deck.
Yeah. Well, and the nice thing is that it's like a world enchantment. It affects everything. It's not a single target, and it really does shut down a lot of decks, actually. Like, my Kikijiki deck would be terrified of this card.
Yep, because, the Kikijiki wants to copy stuff within the battlefield. And
exactly.
Yep. So along the lines of the Torpor Orb, there is this new card in M15. It's called the Hushwing Griff. Have you seen this?
Yes, it just got spoiled recently, and it's awesome.
Yeah, except if you're playing the Flicker deck, in which case it sucks.
Not awesome, yeah. So it essentially does the same thing. Creatures entering the battlefield don't cause abilities to trigger. It's a 2 and a white creature. It's a white Hippogriff, and it's 2/1, but there's two other awesome things about it. It's flash and flying.
Yeah, so it's scary.
It's very scary, especially because you can do it in response to stuff. You can stack it on the stack and just shut down someone's deck.
Yeah, the fact that it's flash is pretty unique because it'll actually they cast something that has an enter the battlefield effect, and then you flash in the Hushwing Griff, and then all of a sudden you basically countered their enter the battlefield effect. Yep. And any more enter battlefield effects they're going to want to cast, like, until they kill this thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you can totally foil their plans for that turn. Yeah. And I'm having nightmares about this card already. Okay, so another thing that that's really good is board wipes and wrath effects. Now, they seem like they wouldn't be great because it's like, oh, he'll just flicker his stuff out. But, you know, here's the thing. If I've got five or six creatures out, I can only flicker a couple of them.
Yeah, that's right.
So what happens is I'm going to still lose most of them. It still hurts. Like, a board wipe in general is very powerful against the flicker deck.
Yeah.
You can flicker a couple of them, but you can't flicker all of them.
And there are board wipes that only get rid of cards on certain other players. If someone's playing black, there is, I think, three or four options that just get rid of a certain player's cards.
Yep.
You know, so there's lots of options to go with here. And board wipes in general, you should always be putting them in your decks. Mm-hmm. Unless your deck really has no other, you know, ways to board wipe. But then, you know, there's great cards, like there's the Eldrazi board wipe, Consume the Meek.
Yeah, All His Dust.
All His Dust is destroyed all non-colored permanents, but Consume the Meek is nice because it destroys everything with mana cost three or less.
Yep.
So for a deck like this, a lot of these creatures are cheap. Yep. They just get wiped off. And
your big creature's still around.
That's right. Everyone else's big creatures are around too. Yep. But at the very least, you could get rid of this threat. So there's lots of options, and board wipes always effective.
Especially instant board wipes, because what you can do is they flicker something during, you know, they say, you say, okay, I'm done, and they go, okay, before your end step, I'm gonna flicker this,
right?
And they use Rune, and now they don't have any mana untapped, and you go, oh yeah, I'm gonna use my Faded Retribution now, and all you're gonna have is one Mole Drifter after this is all over, you know, where you would have saved something else if you knew that was gonna happen. So wrath effects, yeah, they suck when you're playing this deck. You don't want anybody to wrath. Tuck effects are strong. I don't think they're like incredibly strong because you do have other ways to flicker stuff.
Yeah, and this deck is built around flickering everything. So tuck effects it's a good delay.
Yeah, I mean, it'll get rid of Rune and it'll get rid of their good way to flicker something, but it's not like, it's not going to completely shut them down. If they have if they get their Miss Meadow Witch out, and they can get their Miss Meadow Witch if they get their Fauna Shaman or their Survival of the Fittest or any of their tutors to go find it. So it's not going to just put the brakes on fully, but it'll slow them down for sure.
Yeah, and sometimes all you need is one turn, you know? So being able to counter is always good. And the last, Meddling Mage type effects. Meddling Mage is a great character. You can just put him into play and you can name a card, and that card cannot be played.
Yep.
It's great. It costs two. It's a lot of fun. And cards like, there are a bunch of cards that do this, actually.
Yeah, there's Nevermore, I think, is another one. There's a bunch that say, you know, name a card. Yeah, Pithing Needle says activated abilities can't be. You could name Rune with the Pithing Needle, and then you can't tap him to flicker anything anymore.
Yep.
So there's a lot of cards like that. They're going to be effective in the same way.
Yeah, and they're budget too. And in general, they're pretty fun cards to run in commander decks.
You're always going to be able to name somebody's commander, like, you know, and there's going to be a lot of decks that are built around their commander such that it's going to shut them down pretty well.
Yeah, and the new card that's going down very rapidly in price because of Conspiracy reprinting it is Stifle.
Yep.
Which is a great...
it's a one-time use counter target activated or triggered ability.
Yep.
So that can help you. I think against the flicker deck, it's not super powerful because it's not the one ability that's really going to get
lots
you.
Of things.
It's just going to be the fact that they keep doing it. It's sort of a war of attrition. It's just hard to keep up with, you know, them having continuous effects.
Yeah. That's why I think board wipes and Torpor Orb and those sort of things are the most effective.
Oh, Torpor Orb. Torpor Orb. No.
Yeah, that card gives you nightmares.
It does. Okay, let's talk about some stuff that seems like it's a good counter, but it's not that great.
Right. Single target removal. Nope.
Yep.
Flicker in response.
Yep. It's kind of like last week when the Marchesa deck would just sacrifice their stuff in response.
Yeah.
The Rune deck will just flicker itself or its own stuff in response. Yeah. Now, sometimes you can catch him with their pants down and you can target Rune because he himself, he has to flicker another creature. He can't flicker himself.
Right.
But, you know, usually if they're smart, they have a way to protect him.
Yeah, exactly. So like Hexproof, just some Swiftfoot Boots.
Yep.
So
yep.
many different things.
Yep. Control magic effects are, again, for the same reason, flicker in response.
Yep.
Actually, control magic effects even worse. They don't even have to do it in response. They can just wait until another, you know, their turn when they get mana and stuff, and they can flicker it then. Yeah. Oh, and bounce effects, unsummon effects, they're just really bad against this deck.
Literally the worst you could do against this deck.
Yeah, because we were just talking about how this deck might even want to do that to itself.
Right.
So you doing it to them is definitely not, they're not mad about it at all. They're just like, oh, sweet, I get to play this again and get the effect again.
Yeah. For this deck, everything is going to enter the battlefield and do something, so you usually just want to not do that.
Yeah, totally agree.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's talk about, we know how they might try and counter us now. So how do we counter their counters? You know, their disruption is going to come at us. It's going to be the torpor orb. It's going to be board wipes. It's going to be tuck effects that hide our commander deep into our grave or into our library. It's going to be meddling mage, which just doesn't even let us play our commander.
Right.
You know, so how do we get around their disruption? And one of my favorite ways to do this is the planar guide.
Yeah. I just read this card for the first time and I'm like, yep, that's an
awesome. It's an awesome card. It's a one white mana for a 1/1. And then you don't have to tap him. So you can do this. The turn he comes into play, you tap four mana and you remove planar guide from the game. And then you remove all other creatures from the game. That's your opponent's creatures too.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the end of turn, return those cards to play under their owner's control. So what this does is they play a Wrath of God. You play your, you set off your planar guide and all, everything on the board goes to another plane. The wrath takes happens, and at the end of turn, all those cards come back. So you right. avoid the board wipe.
And you usually are going to benefit the most from this because all your cards have entered the battlefield effects.
Yeah.
So you'd be like, all right, cool, when this happens, everyone waits 5 minutes while everything resolves, and you're like, all right, cool,
yeah.
I'm done.
It's like, it's usually like, I play Wrath of God. Okay, I planar guide. All everything leaves the battlefield. The Wrath of God happens. Now everything comes back onto the battlefield, and let's see, I get to destroy three enchantments, an artifact, right. I get to exile a creature, and I get to draw two cards. Like,
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
It's just like, it's, the game's almost over.
It's as though they paid mana for you to do the best thing ever.
Yeah.
And the nice thing is, too, is like, you can even use this if a board wipe doesn't happen.
Yeah,
you know?
Just use it for fun.
Yeah, exactly.
Sometimes it's just Alpha Strike. It's just like, oh, if I just can flicker all my guys one time, I'll win.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, oh, look, everyone else has tokens and stuff. Great. Perfect.
Yep. They're gets rid of back. All the tokens on the board. Somebody exactly. just made like 20 tokens with Prosh. Sorry. Yep. They're all gone.
Another card that's amazing that I realize actually goes really well in the Marchesa deck is Cauldron of Souls, which is a 5-drop artifact, and you can tap it to choose any number of targeted creatures, and each of those creatures gains persist until end of turn, which is another great way to stop a board wipe just for yourself.
Most of your creatures, you have a few 1-1s, but most of them are at least 2-2s.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that's great about this is you can then flicker them later to get rid of the -1/-1 counters they get from persist.
Right.
So they're not even like permanently injured by it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's super strong. Another way around board wipes. It's pretty good in the Marchesa deck. It's also useful as like a group hug mechanic. You can save save other people's creatures that were going to die, mm-hmm. you know? So you can, it's just good. It's if that's the only reason the card's in the deck is for group hug type, like help other people, I think it's not that strong. But if it's just like incidental, like, oh, I'll usually use it for myself, but I could use it to help someone else.
Yeah,
then
like,
I think
hey, you
powerful.
Have an Angel of Serenity. Well, guess what? You get exiled another 3 cards and just don't choose mine and I'll make sure it lives.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So lots of fun stuff that can happen there.
The next one I'm thinking of is Avacyn.
Oh, yeah.
Angel of Hope.
Making everything indestructible usually is a pretty good effect.
You can notice that most of the most of these are ways to get around board wipes, because board wipes are one of the scariest things that can happen to a deck like this. Because you get your whole board set up, you're like, I have an answer to everything. Like, I have a creature that does this, I have a creature that does this. And then somebody wipes the board and you're like, oh, crap, I'm screwed.
Yeah.
But if you have Avacyn out, it's really hard for them to wipe the board and kill everything because it all has an indestructible. I mean, Toxic Deluge could do it.
Yeah, but then they're taking a big hit to their life just to kill Avacyn.
Yeah.
So, you know, at the very least... No.
And you can still flicker a couple things.
Right. And they still lose a little bit of life.
Yeah, that's true.
And you can flicker Avacyn, really. It's the most important.
Mm-hmm. And then because of the Torpor Orb, you need at least a card or two that destroys artifacts but isn't a creature that has an enter the battlefield effect. So you need, you know, some type of disenchant.
Right.
Some type of... Hopefully it's reoccurring. But even Aura Shards requires an enter that comes into play.
Yeah.
So the Torpor Orb stops that. So you need to make sure that your deck has one or two ways to get rid of an artifact that isn't an enter the battlefield effect.
Yeah,
because
even just stealing the artifact is a way to get rid of it, to be honest.
No, no, stealing it won't do it. It affects
the
whole
board. Oh,
right,
for Torpor Orb, that's right. Yeah, correct. Sorry about that,
You need something that gets rid of it that's an instant or a sorcery.
Just counter it.
Yep, just counter it. You always want counter spells, and that's number 5.
Yep.
Counter spells is blues. If you're playing blue, that's a potential answer to anything.
Yeah, that's your bread and butter.
Mm-hmm.
You got to have counter spells in your deck. And when it comes to commander, there's you know, it's the toolbox. You got to have hinder. You got to have the regular counter spell. You got to have Glenn the Lender counter spell in the creature. You know, all these things are just so effective. And if you don't have them, then you're asking to get hurt, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about how this deck like plays out.
Yeah, what are the win conditions?
It generally wins by having enough answers to eventually sort of take over the game and lock the board down. The trick is playing out your threats only when needed and not scaring everyone. You know,
yeah.
If you can play this deck incorrectly, and it's usually like just playing everything out for no reason.
Yeah.
You know, you're going to end up holding a lot of your cards and sort of using them when you need to use them. You want to get some sort of protection out for your commander for Rune before you play him out.
Yep.
Generally. So getting the Miss Meadow Witch out. Again, I wouldn't play the Miss Meadow Witch out unless I had at least six mana. So it's two to player and then four to activate her ability so that I can at least protect her.
Yeah.
And then the next time, you know, I can play Rune and now I can maybe protect them both or at least protect one of them.
Yeah. And have extra mana to equip, you know, Swiftfoot Boots or, you know, any number of things on them to protect them even more.
And then once you get your Fauna Shaman or your Survival of the Fittest or a couple of tutors, like, you're in really good shape because you're going to be feeling like, oh, no matter what anybody plays, I will have an answer for it.
Yeah.
And I'll be able to go find that answer because I'll have the ways to find it. So that's sort of how this, it plays really control-y. If you get a Perplexing Chimera and a Glenelendra out and a way to flicker them, like, all of a sudden the whole game changes and all revolves around, like, holy crap, how do I get anything through?
Yeah. And specifically, we have to team up to get rid of Rune at this point because there's
but
so many.
But even then, it's very, very hard.
Yep.
With the Perplexing Chimera out and Glenelendra, it's extremely hard for even three players teaming up on you to do anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Because they play one thing, you counter it with Glenelendra. Mm-hmm. Now they play another thing, you steal the thing and give them the Perplexing Chimera in return, and then you flicker their Perplexing Chimera and get it back. And now the next thing, so they need four or five answers between the three or four of them. It's if you can get those things on the board, the Glenelendra, the Perplexing Chimera, and ways to continuously flicker them,
you could lock the whole thing down.
You have a chance at locking three or four players out, you know.
And playing this deck, you should know that. You should know that these are the cards now. So if you ever do see them and Rune's coming up against you, you can be like, okay, here are things that we need to address as a group immediately.
And you have to address them before they happen. Once stuff hits the table, sometimes you're in big trouble.
Because exactly.
It's very powerful once the stuff is landed because you can flicker it out. So it's very hard to get rid of the thing, the keep components that you want to get rid of.
Yeah, Glenelendra can start countering from the moment she hits the table.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, so that'll do it for episode two. Hopefully you guys learned something about politics negotiations. As always, we'll put the deck list
in the show notes.
Yeah, you know, hopefully if you've got some suggestions of how to change the deck list, you can do that in the comments.
Yeah, and the great thing is that every deck list is so conditional to the group that they're being played in. So, you know, it's a starting point.
Yeah.
If you don't want to pay, you know, however much it costs to get Survival of the Fittest, there are other options. You know, so you can switch stuff around. There's always budget options for Magic cards. They may not be as powerful, but in a game like Commander, fortunately, that doesn't matter as much.
Like we said, sometimes less powerful cards are good.
Yep, exactly.
Also, tailor it to your playgroup. Like we said before, you know, if nobody's playing any Wrath effects, you don't have to worry about all these things that get around Wrath effects. If nobody's playing any, you know, counter spells, you don't have to worry about, you know, getting countered. Like, don't put stuff into your deck that's going to, like, take care of something that nobody else is going to play.
Although I guarantee you, if you play this deck enough, you will have to start worrying about those because people start putting them in.
That's true.
All right, so the next episode of the Command Zone, we're going to talk about a sweet set that just came out called Conspiracy.
Which is awesome. We've been having so much fun with it.
Yeah, I've drafted it already, I think, six or seven times, and I do not plan on stopping anytime soon.
It's really made for EDH players, too. So while we may not be talking about a specific EDH deck, it's... if you like EDH, you will like this format. Don't miss it.
Yeah, don't miss it. Great multiplayer fun and a lot of really fun cards to talk about that introduce a bunch of new mechanics to the game.
Yeah, it's super fun.
Cool. So if you are listening to this podcast, we'd like to let you know that there's also an option to watch it on YouTube. So just check out the links. It's all going to be in the show notes.
It's really cool because you can actually see the cards as we talk about them.
Yeah. But if you're just listening to this in your car and you can't do that, no worries. But if you're watching this and want to listen to it in your car or when you're falling asleep at night, you can download the podcast and subscribe. There is an RSS feed for all that stuff.
Yeah, you can listen to our sweet, sweet voices as you fall asleep at night.
And that's all. What?
We're not going to put people to sleep.
No, hopefully not.
All right. Until next time.
See you later.
Thank you for your attention. For further inquiries, send an email to commandcast@rocketjump.com. Or ask us on Twitter @JFWong and @JoshLeeKwai. See you later, alligator.
Greetings, humans.